In a Peanuts cartoon strip, Charlie Brown and Lucy, they're having this philosophical conversation. Lucy says, "Life is like a deck chair, Charlie Brown. Some place it so they can see where they're going. Some place it so they can see where they've been. And some place it so they can see where they are at present." Charlie Brown replies, "I can't even get mine unfolded." And in the book of Ecclesiastes, King Solomon is having a hard time getting his deck chair unfolded. He's frustrated. He's vexed, trying to make sense out of his life. Life can at times be perplexing. Winston Churchill once described the country of Russia as a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. That's how a lot of people feel about life. As one person put it, "Life goes on, I just forgot why." Life is a knot that refuses to come untangled. It's a dilemma, a predicament, a puzzle. Life is a Rubik's Cube. We begin life as if we were following that proverbial rainbow, and at the end of the rainbow, we expect to find a pot of gold. But that's not the way how life always pans out. It's been suggested that the author of Ecclesiastes, he intends to show us that at the end of life's rainbow lies not a pot of gold, but a pot of salty liver soup. How do you feel when things don't go as you had planned, as you had expected? All too often, concepts like fairness and fulfillment seem like a fleeting fantasy. Life can get rough. It can be full of disappointment and disillusionment. You'll relate to Ecclesiastes if life has ever left you with a bitter taste. Christian statesman Charles Colson once wrote, "Life isn't a book. Life isn't logical or sensible or orderly. Life is a mess most of the time, and theology must be lived in the midst of that mess." Well, Ecclesiastes is King Solomon's attempt at finding meaning in the mess. In chapter 1, Solomon, he introduces himself and he begins his quest for meaning in verse 1. Chapter 1, verse 1. "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem." Understand this word Ecclesiastes, it's the Greek word for preacher. Solomon is a politician by trade, but for a time he assumes the role of preacher to teach us a few lessons about life. You remember this Solomon. He began a godly man, but there was a period in his life when he turned his back on God. He tried to find meaning and purpose apart from God. And if ever there was a man who could have achieved that goal, it certainly would have been Solomon. The Bible tells us that he was the wisest and the wealthiest man who ever lived. Scholars came from all over the world to match wits with Solomon. He would host these battle of the brains, and all his challengers would leave marveling at his wisdom. Solomon also had some cash to flash. You think Johnny Manziel was the first one walking around doing this number? How about Solomon? He was the king of the bling. He had a yearly stipend of 666 talents of gold. Now, the talent was a measurement of about 100 pounds. So Solomon's annual income was 66,000 plus ounces of gold. That's 1,000,000 ounces. At current prices, that's $1.3 billion a year. One Old Testament commentator writes, "No era of Israel's history was richer in possibilities for various pleasures, and no person in a better position to make the most of them than Solomon." This preacher, he used his position and his power and even his purse to experiment with everything imaginable in pursuit of deep down fulfillment in his life. First, Solomon, he travels down the path of science and philosophy. Then he takes a turn and he goes down the road of pleasure, on to achievement. Then he moves to religion, materialism, fame, and power. He contemplated the value of hard work and long life, a large family, a good name. Ecclesiastes is Solomon's thesis. On his trek down these various avenues of life, he pauses to report his findings. And he begins with an initial observation, verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? Oh my. That's an eloquent way of saying, why bother to roll out of the sack tomorrow morning? I mean, what's the use in facing another day? All of life is vanity and futility. This word vanity is the key word in Ecclesiastes. It means vapor or mist. And it implies emptiness, hollowness, dissatisfaction, frustration, a lack of fulfillment. The word vanity, it appears 37 times in Ecclesiastes. And it sums up King Solomon's conclusions about life. Without God, life on earth is no more meaningful than the steam you might wipe from the shower door in the morning, or a warm puff of breath on a cold winter's morning. It's here for a second or two, and then suddenly it's gone. The Hebrew word translated vanity could be rendered whatever is left after you break a soap bubble. Life without God is like chasing soap bubbles, according to the preacher. I watch my grandkids. Kathy has a bottle of soap bubbles she keeps out on the front deck. And she'll take the grandkids out and she'll blow those soap bubbles up into the air. And I love to watch them chase the bubbles. And they catch them. They do. But the moment they capture their prize, it pops. And there they stand, holding in their hands nothing but air. The kids are exhausted and absolutely, they have absolutely nothing to show for their efforts chasing those soap bubbles. Well, have you been chasing soap bubbles? Ecclesiastes says that's all that life is about, is chasing soap bubbles. Expending lots of effort and having nothing to show for it. Another key phrase appears in verse 3, under the sun. This phrase appears 29 times in Ecclesiastes, and it's an important point to the understanding of this book. For Solomon here is limiting his search to things, quote, under the sun. Not heavenly things, but earthly things. His boundaries are below the material and the physical pursuits of life. When Solomon conducted this experiment, he tried to keep God out of the picture. He tried to make sense of life without factoring God into his equation. And of course, Solomon is not the only man who's tried to find meaning in life apart from God. Other brilliant men have tried and come to the same conclusions. For example, George Bernard Shaw once moaned, "Life is a series of inspired follies." An old French proverb states, "Life is an onion and one cries while peeling it." The Jewish rabbi Sholem Aleichem wrote, "Life is a blister on top of a tumor and a boil on top of that." He must have been a lifelong Atlanta Hawks fan. Shakespeare put into the mouth of Macbeth, "Life is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." William Cowper described life apart from God by likening it to the toil of dropping buckets into empty wells and growing old in drawing up nothing. And no less a philosopher than that cartoon character Charlie Brown once said, "I have a new philosophy. I'm only going to dread one day at a time." If all there was to life was what exists under the sun, I too would be pessimistic. But there is more to life. You remember Ephesians chapter 1, verse 3. Ephesians informs us that God has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places in Christ. You see, get above the sun. Reach into the heavenlies and you'll find blessings galore. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58, counters Solomon's conclusions. Paul tells those who serve Jesus, "Your labor is not in vain. All is not vanity. Life is not worthless." In fact, life can be satisfying and fulfillment when you look above the sun, when you look to Jesus Christ. Look under the sun, and life's a drag. But look to the sun, the S-O-N, and life takes on a whole new wonder and meaning. Hey, when we come to Jesus and connect to God and relate our lives to Him, the value of life's experiences all get marked up. All of life, our work, our play, our relationships now take on an eternal significance. It was H.G. Wells who wrote, "Until a man has found God and been found by God, he begins at no beginning. He works to no end. He may have his friendships, his partial loyalties, his scraps of honor, but all these things fall into place and life falls into place only with God." And this is the truth that Solomon will finally affirm. But first, he has some roads to go down. And he moans some more here in verse 4. He says, "One generation passes away, and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever." You see, Solomon is going to compare the temporariness of man with the permanence of nature. He points out that the trees in your yard will outlive you. Hey, you'll die before your shrubs. Our lives are just a blip on the radar screen of history. Solomon points out how nature runs like clockwork. The sun rises, the sun sets. Life goes on as if man were never here. In fact, the individual person plays a minor role in the grand scheme of things. And Solomon's point is this: though there's motion, there's no meaning. He suggests that most of us are trapped on the treadmill. Hey, we live a life called a rut. People, families, nations come and go. Actors, props change. But the stage and the script and the storyline remain the same. And this is why people long for something new, something novel, something to break the boredom. They crave a distinguishing mark on themselves or an experience that'll make them feel special, distinct from the crowd. Solomon hates to disappoint those who revel in the novel, but he says that there's really nothing new under the sun. Notice he tells us in verse 9, "That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, 'See, this is new'? It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things. Or will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after?" For an example, just look at today's fashions. I mean, what goes around comes around. Styles are cyclical, aren't they? Hold on to your outdated threads long enough and your teenager will be wearing them in a few years. The Greeks used to say, "The ancients have stolen all our best ideas." One other Greek philosopher put it, "They that come after us will see nothing new, and they who went before us saw nothing more than we have seen." That's just another way of agreeing with Solomon. He's telling us, there's nothing new under the sun. And this is why we need to be careful about religious teachings that claim to be new and novel. Remember, Satan is skilled at dressing up an old lie and putting it in a new wrapper. If you ever studied the New Age religions, these new ideas that are floating about today, you'll realize that they're nothing more than the old lie Satan sold Eve in the Garden of Eden. You can be your own God. Just look within. Always remember this: if it's new, it's not true. And if it's true, it's not new. Only Jesus can do a truly new work. In Revelation chapter 21, he says, "Behold, I make all things new." He puts a new song on our lips, the Bible tells us, a new desire in our hearts. He gives us a new start, a new hope, a new home, a new family, a new power, a whole new life. Well, in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, Solomon turns down a different road, and he looks to pleasure. Notice verse 1. "I said in my heart, 'Come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure.' But surely, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, 'Madness,' and of mirth, 'What does it accomplish?' I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their life." In other words, for a time, Solomon was the Hebrew hedonist. He tried to find meaning through pleasure. He became a party animal. He grabbed for all the gusto. If it felt good, he did it. He obeyed his thirst. Solomon adopted the motto, life is short, play hard. And wow, did Solomon play hard. 1,000 wives and concubines, can you imagine? Wine and women and wealth. For a while, Solomon's palace was a perpetual party. And understand, with Solomon's salary, he could pay for the finest in food and entertainment. His parties made the Las Vegas Strip look like a two-bit carnival. Solomon partied hardy, but he found no purpose in his pleasure. He found no satisfaction in his sensuality, no contentment in his cravings, no real love in all of his lusts. But if ever there were people trying to duplicate Solomon's pursuit for finding meaning and pleasure, it would be those 21st century Americans, you and me. For we are a pleasure-crazed society, are we not? Did you know that every week in the United States of America, 12 million golfers vie for tee times? 9 million tennis players compete across the nets? 4 million skiers glide down the slopes, and each year, 23 million hunters and fishermen comb the woods and fish the creeks. And many of these pleasure seekers are doing so because they're trying to fill an inner emptiness. Living for the weekend has become their reason to exist. Earlier in Proverbs, Solomon said in chapter 14, verse 3, even in laughter, the heart may sorrow, and the end of mirth may be grief. In other words, when the party's over, life is still vanity. Time magazine once described our modern era with this phrase, anything goes, but nothing lasts. Boy, that sums up a lot of people's lives. And this was Solomon. He had it all, but nothing really mattered. Remember, Jesus told the woman at the well, you will thirst again. The refreshment that she could receive from that well, it wouldn't last. Oh, it would quench your thirst, but only for a short time. It was temporary and superficial. In fact, I think we ought to take Jesus' statement there and turn it into a plaque and hang it over every source of satisfaction and refreshment that this world has to offer. Above sex and drugs and fame and money and sports and leisure and entertainment, above all those things, you should hang a plaque. You will thirst again. You will. Get what you want, but it'll never be enough. Only Jesus can quench our deep down spiritual thirst. It was written of that prolific author, Ernest Hemingway. He was born in 1899 and was the epitome of the 20th century man. At age 25, he sipped champagne in Paris, had well-publicized game hunts in Africa, and hunted grizzly bears in the Northwest. At the age of 61, after having it all, wine, women, song, a distinguished literary career, and Sunday afternoon bullfights in Spain, Hemingway chose to end his life blowing his head off, leaving a note saying, life is one darn thing after another. Pleasure is fun for a season, but when the party's over, all is still vanity, Solomon would tell us. And yet parties and pleasure weren't the end of Solomon's pursuits. Before long, his search for meaning turned from enjoyment to employment, from what he could consume to what he could construct. Solomon tried his hand at business. He says in chapter 2, verse 4, I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, some 30,000 according to 1 Kings. The delights of the sons of men and musical instruments of all kind, So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. And then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled. And indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. The king went about building for himself an empire. He labored and he built and he profited. And yet, all of his ambition ended with the conclusion, so what? I mean, big deal. Is that all? Once there was an extremely successful businessman, but he was dissatisfied. And he had gone to his pastor for some guidance. The man confessed, for years I've been climbing the ladder of success, but just recently I've discovered it's been leaning against the wrong wall. Have you been climbing a ladder that's been leaning against the wrong wall? No less an authority on money than the Wall Street Journal published the following quote, "Money is an article which may be used as a universal passport to everywhere except heaven and as a universal provider of everything except happiness." Solomon concludes in chapter 2 that purpose is not found in a purse or worth in a wallet or satisfaction in a sale. Business and busyness don't always equal blessedness. In fact, there's a cathedral in Milan, Italy, that has three doors going into the front of it. The one on the right side reads, right above it, it reads, "All that pleases is but for a moment." You go to the one on the far left-hand side, and above the door reads these words, "All that troubles is but for a moment." All that pleases, all that troubles is but for a moment. But over the middle door, it reads, "Nothing's important except that which is eternal." And you see, this is Solomon's assessment of life. And yet in chapter 3, Solomon makes another discovery. This time the preacher tells us that God has taken a chip off of eternity and he has actually planted it in every human heart. Ecclesiastes 3 verse 11 tells us that God has put eternity in their hearts. Did you know that God has put eternity in our hearts? God places within each of us a tugging, a need, a frustration that this world can't satisfy, that can only be satiated by a touch of eternity. In other words, there's a God-shaped hole in each one of us. And this is heaven's homing device. For just as a bird has migratory instincts and the salmon swims upstream to the spot where he was spawned, God has also put within each of us a longing that won't be satisfied until we make our way back to Him, until we have found our fulfillment in Him. As Augustine prayed, "You have formed us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." It's this inner emptiness that points us back to God. Well, in chapters 4 and 5, Solomon marches us down another avenue. This time he flirts with fame and power. In verse 16, he brings up a king who rises from poverty to sit on the throne. There was no end of all the people over which he was made king. Yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. I mean, this king reigns over a huge kingdom, but no one remembers him once he's gone. And this caused Solomon to think, why work so hard to be famous if you're forgotten before your corpse grows cold? Who among us remembers the 25th president of the United States? Who won the World Series in 1934? Who founded General Motors? Who invented the ballpoint pen? I would imagine all these accomplishments were pretty big deals at the time, but who remembers them now? How fickle were the cheers of the crowd on that Sunday when Jesus rode into Jerusalem. They all shouted, "Hosanna." They hailed him as their king. And yet 4 days later, the same voices screamed, "Crucify him, crucify him." You see, fame is such a fleeting thing. And then in chapter 5, verse 8, the preacher writes of another frustration that made his life difficult. Chapter 5, verse 8, "If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter. Why? For high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them." That explains Washington, D.C. today. Solomon was king, and you'd think the king could clean up the courts, but he concedes injustice. Man, it's just a part of life. Why? Because high official watches over high official. They're all in cahoots. There's an old Spanish proverb, "Laws, like the spider's web, catch the fly and let the hawks go free." The real perpetrators managed to escape. I heard that a jury was defined as 12 persons chosen to decide who has the best lawyer. Isn't that our problem today? I'm afraid that's what's become of the judicial system in America. We expect right to be rewarded and evil to be punished, but that's not always how life pans out, is it? Often the cheater gets the higher grade. The liar gets elected to office. The embezzler drives the Mercedes and lives in the mansion. The immoral man gets the pretty woman. When injustice occurs, life turns into a crushing disappointment, a confounding contradiction. You see, as long as we're depending on sinful people to hold sinful people responsible, true justice will elude us, won't it? High official watches over high official. You see, everywhere Solomon turns, his conclusion is the same. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And at the end of chapter 5, he pauses to draw another conclusion. Verse 18, he says, "Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart." You see, based on Solomon's tone to this point, we might think that he would advise us to live an austere life. Take a vow of poverty. Separate yourself from all things material and physical. But instead, Solomon says that we should enjoy the gifts that God gives us. Take a walk in the park. Treat yourself to a ball game. Eat an ice cream cone, man. Hey, have a hot dog for lunch today. Lighten up a little bit. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17 tells us that God gives us richly all things to enjoy. Solomon isn't saying life is bad, so go hide in a closet. To the contrary, he's encouraging us to enjoy life. Just don't expect more out of it than it can give. Let me say that again. Enjoy your life, but please don't expect more out of it than life can give. You see, a new mom, she thinks that her child is going to end her unhappiness and bring her fulfillment. Sorry. Instead, that baby might cause you a few unhappy nights. A businessman, he longs for a raise and a promotion. He thinks if he can just get that new job, all his problems will be over. Sorry. Every new job comes with new headaches. A single person assumes that if he or she can just get married, then their life will find new meaning. Sorry. Marriage is a blessing, but it doesn't work miracles. Hey, a new car, that's the ticket. Oh, if I can just get that new car. But do you really think that a chunk of steel and some paint and movable parts is really going to make you happy? You're selling yourself pretty short. You see, generally speaking, life is good. Having kids, being married, this is wonderful. That new job, that higher pay, that's good too. A new car, sure, I'll take one. But our problem is that we expect more out of these things than they can deliver. You see, stuff only stuffs an appetite. It doesn't really satisfy. Our real longing is for something more. It's for a piece of the eternal. That's why life under the sun will never bring you true and lasting peace. In fact, most of the time, we don't even enjoy the blessings that we have because we expect too much from them. They don't fulfill our inner longings, and so we get disappointed. We want way more out of life than it can give. Jason Lehman sort of sums it up. Believe it or not, he was 14 years old when he wrote this. He wrote a little poem that he submitted to a Dear Abby column. She printed it. Here's what Jason wrote. It was spring, but it was summer I wanted. The warm days and the great outdoors. It was summer, but it was fall I wanted. The colorful leaves in the cool, dry air. It was fall, but it was winter I wanted. The beautiful snow and the joy of the holiday season. I was a child, but it was adulthood I wanted. The freedom and the respect. I was 20, but it was 30 I wanted. To be mature and sophisticated. I was middle age, but it was 20 I wanted. The youth and the free spirit. I was retired, but it was middle age I wanted. The presence of mind without limitations. My life was over, but I never got what I wanted. Do you get the point? We expect more out of life than it can give, and we don't enjoy the blessing that it is. You see, taken in and of itself, everything in life is really worthless. I mean, you work a job only to provide food so you can go back and work the next day, and this just goes on and on and on the rest of your life. So you bring kids into the world for what? So they can bring kids into the world? And then their kids can bring kids into the world? I mean, where does it all lead? What does it really accomplish? Solomon will discover that life becomes meaningful only as it relates to God. You see, it's only when life gets marked up with eternal value that we can see real meaning in life. My job becomes significant only when I view it as an opportunity to be a witness for Jesus, to do something eternal on that job. My home becomes a temple, a sacred place, when I can teach and represent God to my wife and to my kids. My money becomes valuable only when I use it to bless others and to advance God's work. You see, my job is more than a paycheck. My home is more than a place where I store my junk and sleep where I between work. My earnings are more than a temptation to my heirs. You see, all of life goes better with God. Solomon says that the gifts of God can't truly be enjoyed and appreciated apart from the God who gives us those gifts. It's our relationship with God that gives our life meaning. Well, in chapters 7 through 9, Solomon again brings up another frustration in life. In fact, this may be his greatest frustration. And that's death. In fact, he says, it's better to be a living dog than a dead lion. Think about that. Well, at least the living dog has life, and with life comes hope. I'd rather be a living dog than a dead lion. Solomon is saying, enjoy your life while you got it, for in the end, both the good and the bad will end up dead. Death is the great spoiler, is it not? And it adds to life's vanity. Notice in chapter 9, verse 2, Solomon writes, chapter 9, verse 2. All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good, the clean, and the unclean. To him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath is he who fears an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live. And after that, they go to the dead. Death is the common denominator. I don't know if you've paid attention to this, but the statistics are quite impressive. One out of every one person dies. Woody Allen cracks. It's not that I'm afraid to die. I just don't want to be there when it happens. But he will be. See, death is the one appointment we all will keep. Two people born in different countries, living in different cultures, speaking a different language, come from two completely different worlds, and yet they share the same destiny, do they not? One day, we're all going to die. And the reality of death is that it robs life of much of its joy and meaning. Even when life is at its best, we live with this nagging realization that it won't last forever. As the old saying goes, all good things come to an end. So what if I accumulate a nest egg? I can't take it with me. There's a Jewish proverb that states, shrouds have no pockets. Or as the old preacher stated, I've never seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul. And logic should tell us that if it's something we can't take with us, then it's probably not that important in the first place. You see, under the sun, men share a common destiny. They die. But it's above the sun, it's after death, that the road forks. One lane goes to heaven, the other lane goes to hell. Puritan pastor Thomas Watson wrote this sobering truth: eternity to the godly is a day that has no sunset. Eternity to the wicked is a night that has no sunrise. There's an Indiana graveyard that has a tombstone with the following inscription: pause, stranger, when you pass me by. As you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you will be. So prepare for death and follow me. Well, stranger did pass by. Fella had a quick wit. He read the inscription, and below it he carved his own words in the tombstone. He said, to follow you, I'm not content until I know the way you went. Always remember, death is not an accident. Death, my friends, is an appointment. Hebrews 9, verse 27 tells us, it is appointed for men to die once, but after this, the judgment. One day, every man will stand before his Creator and give an account for the choices he made in the life that he lived. Every man. Well, in chapter 12, verse 13, Solomon reveals his conclusions, his final analysis of his study on life. Chapter 12, verse 13, Solomon writes, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. Here's the conclusion of Solomon's experiment. He's tried all that life has to offer, and all that really matters is to submit to God's authority and to walk in his will. Fear God and keep his commandments. All of life can be boiled up into that. That's it. Here is the whole enchilada. I mean, here is what it's all about. Fear God and keep his commandments. To fear God is to agree that he knows better how to live my life than I do. God created life and he's given us instructions. We call it the Bible, so we can live our lives to the fullest. To fear God is to respect him as my creator, as my Lord, as my final authority. It's to bow my knee before him and to ask, God, what will you have me to do? Here's life. Fear God and keep his commandments. Even as Christians, we can so easily lose perspective. The world around us is so visible and tangible. It curls around us like a tentacle to pull us into its web. It's a Pied Piper that plays a tune we're tempted to follow. The lure of this physical world sucks us in and clouds our thoughts and lulls us into believing that it is all that there is. And before we know it, we're searching for meaning and fulfillment in things, quote, under the sun. Once there was a man and his family. They were visiting Niagara Falls early in the spring. Ice was flowing down the river. Frozen in the ice were carcasses of dead fish, and feeding on the carcasses were a handful of gulls. These gulls were riding the ice until just before the chunks rolled off of the precipice and crashed onto the river rocks below. As soon as the frozen dinner trays got close to the edge, the gulls would then pull off of the ice and fly away. Well, the man was watching as one of the gulls feasted on his dinner. But he noticed this gull seemed to be oblivious to the danger. He rode the ice block for too long. And as the ice rolled off of the ledge and the bird started flapping his wings, he discovered that his extra delay had caused his feet to freeze to the ice. The bird crashed with his dinner still in his teeth. Hey, God has given us all things to enjoy. But if we get too attached to anything under the sun, we're headed for a crashing disappointment. Again, it was Augustine who said, "The soul of man is made with sweet tastes that only God Himself is rich enough to satisfy." Have you been trying to feel that inner hunger on lesser things? Things that can never satisfy? Look to life. Look to the life around you for more than it can offer. And it becomes a miry quicksand. But look through life to the God who created all things. Then fear God and keep His commandments. And life becomes a wonderful discovery of all God's joys and blessings. Reinhold Messner was a famous mountain climber. He was the first of two men to climb Mount Everest without an oxygen bottle. And then he climbed the mountain again, this time by himself. It was a daring and dangerous venture, but Messner succeeded. Afterwards, he was asked, as all mountain climbers are, "Why did you do it?" And Reinhold Messner replied, "Because at the top, all the lines converge." Because at the top, all the lines converge. And that's the way it is in life. When you focus on things under the sun and approach life from a strictly human perspective, life is a puzzle with missing pieces. But live your life for the sun, in the light of God's Son, Jesus, and all the lines converge. All of life comes together and makes sense. Here again is the conclusion of the matter. Man's all in all is to fear God and keep His commandments. I pray that is or becomes the bottom line to your life. Perhaps you've been looking for fulfillment under the sun. You've been chasing after soap bubbles. Well, I'm here this morning to invite you to life in the sun, in God's Son, Jesus Christ. Today, my friend, if you give your life to Jesus, He will give Himself to you. His pardon and His power, His fullness and His freedom, His peace and His joy. What a swap. What are you waiting on?